Blog Talk Radio.
We're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
We'll be right back.
good evening, good evening, good evening, and welcome. Welcome to another edition of Soul Tree Radio on the Raw. I'm your host, Mike Lewis Engelman. As always, it is good to be with you. Soul Tree Radio on the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com and the Assassins of the Black Athlete Sports Network. Get all the good stuff, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, right now at www.BASNNewsroom.com. Shout out to the members of the Brotherman Network, of which two of them were with me, Gary Norris Gray and Radio Reggie. And right now, we're going to entertain something different because last week I was looking for something. I was looking for more information about Monsieur Ballon, who was the central character of the movie Chevalier, a black man who was given the title of knight, essentially. And his life was intertwined with the French Revolution and other kinds of good stuff. Firstly, before I go any further, Reggie Gary, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Peace and blessings, deacons, for the sense of justice.
Yes, indeed. Now, as I was doing that, I ran into some other topics that really kind of hit a wall in my psyche. And then I said, no shit. This is what we've always been talking about. And the professor has always been guilty as charged for this because he always talks about how the white man's ice was cold and the water was wet, et cetera, et cetera. And it seemed like a racist trope when I first heard it, but then somebody asked the question, as my man Tony McClain is here, why do people buy Cadillacs? Now, it's more like, why do black people buy Cadillacs? I won't get into that right now, but I want to first get to the fact that my Ding Ding Dallas, Ding Ding Stars, have made it to the next round.
Ding Ding Dallas, Ding Ding Stars. Yes, sir.
Hockey has been amazing over the last couple of years. Only in hockey can an expansion team like the Kraken take out the champions as in the Colorado Avalanche. They snow them under. And Tony, this is consistent with hockey and the growth sector. I don't know if hockey will ever pass basketball, but can you see how much it's grown?
Well, it's a regional thing because, in Canada, of course, it's king. But here in the U.S., I think it really depends on, where you're at. You know, you've got three teams in the New York metropolitan area, so it's big there, even though none of the teams are all three of the teams are now out playing golf. the thing with the NHL is that in many ways, depending on where you're at in the country, there's still some people that are still almost trying to get reacquainted with them. You know, you see the situation now, you see what's going on with the Panthers and with Carolina.
True.
These are two fan bases that 15, 20 years ago would have been unfathomable to think about, but both of them are now one game away from the Stanley Cup final.
And well, then you see the situation. Real quick, what are the three teams in New York as far as the hockey? I know the Rangers, Islanders, and who else?
The Devils.
Well, that's Jersey. I thought it was three teams in New York.
New York metropolitan area for the most part.
Okay.
And Buffalo. Yeah, I guess, yeah, and Buffalo. But then you see what's going on with Arizona, where the folks voted down.
Did you
they voted down. They're not going to give them. They voted down the money for a new arena. So they're probably, you know, they're probably going to pass. Well, it depends on who you listen to. Now, one would say Quebec, but apparently Houston is in the mix as well. And there's one other city that they're talking about. It's a couple of former WHA cities. Houston's one. I can't remember what the other one is. It's actually another team in the South. And I forget. But, yeah, it depends. It depends on where
you're
at.
You know, I think Georgia don't have a hockey team.
Well, no, I don't think they're gonna get a third shot. Because see, you know, they had the old Flames there once. They had the Thrashers, and the Thrashers, you know, the sad thing is the Thrashers got hurt more by their front office than what they actually did on the ice. They were actually becoming a better team. But unfortunately,
you have
to go through some mess.
But Arizona hockey just don't add up.
But also they didn't have, you know, the arena, I guess, that they played in was sort of antiquated. I mean, basically now they're playing at Arizona State University now, which seats about 5 or 6. That's the thing. But the only reason why they're still there is that I guess Gary Bettman, for lack of a better word, has a hard on for Phoenix, and they're trying to, but you know, at some point you just have to say, look, you can't force people to go now.
Think about this year, Final Four.
Vegas, calling Vegas a South team might be pushing it just a little bit.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. I know.
Well, in many ways, though, it sort of shows you where the NHL is going. Because usually you get one original 16. Bupkis on this. You usually get a Canadian team. Bupkis on that, too. You've basically got, if you go by your history, basically you've got two expansion teams, the Hartford Whalers and the Minnesota North Stars in the Final Four.
And it
sort of shows you where the NHL, you know, it sort of gives the best of both worlds. Now, we always lament about what happens with the Canadian teams, and you know that's something that's still, who knows, whatever. It's not going to happen overnight. And one would think that the Coyotes would be a perfect fit for Quebec City, but we thought they would be somewhat of a perfect fit a few years ago, and then Vegas got it, and then we came around again, then Seattle got it. And see, the thing is, both of them have been wildly successful. I mean, you know, we all know what the Knights did, you know, that first year, saw what the Kraken did their second year. So, you know, the NHL has been very successful, sort of, you know, in broad, you know, hiding in broad daylight, so to speak, in some instances.
That's a good way of putting it.
But yeah. And you know, with the NBA, I guess we can sort of poo-poo. I guess all the folks that said that playing in the bubble didn't mean anything. We basically got this, what were the four teams that were in the bubble in the conference finals just a couple years ago. So
yeah.
it's an interesting time for it's definitely an interesting time for both of their postseasons because
it's the same time. But you know, I remain pissed about Kevin Hart's ignorant ass and the take on the Allen Iverson practice video that turned out to be that commercial for Chase. Now, full thing, I have a Chase account, and I seriously thought about canceling it after I first saw it. Now I'm pissed, and as I was going through all this, I was thinking, why is that? Well, we know there's a resentment factor when it comes to black folks, but
Why would they do that? I don't
understand
why they would do that.
That's my point.
It just shows you how ruthless they're willing to do just to sell bullshit, for lack of a better word.
Exactly, because they wouldn't have gone after a Jewish icon or a white icon with something like that. They made a point of going after Iverson, and Iverson, I doubt he's going to make it a legal issue, but everybody knows as soon as Kevin Hart started that BS, where it was going to go. And it was like, fuck you, Kevin Hart, and fuck you, Chase. Now, having said that,
why would Curry be in that commercial? I got to say, what Curry do?
True that. And the T-shirt said cash, and it was a dollar sign with bros. So it was the Cash Money Brothers, which, of course, came from New Jack City, and got to wonder, not W, not X, but why did they decide to use that as a logo for this mythical team that Kevin Hart bought, supposedly with his credit card? As I say this, I leave you with this until the half hour when my little sister Jenny gets here to talk about the Preakness, but we want to know why black people love Cadillacs.
Have you ever wondered why black people love Cadillacs? For African Americans, Cadillacs were not just a popular brand, but they became a symbol of success and pride. And as it turns out, Cadillacs didn't become a fan favorite of African Americans by accident. During the beginning of the 20th century, cars began to enter the American landscape. During that period, car makers started to pop up all over the place. In 1903 alone, 57 companies were established, but shortly thereafter, 27 of them went bankrupt. And longest surviving brands in automotive history, having entered the market as General Motors' luxury brand in 1903, the brand was almost an immediate success and quickly developed a reputation for excellence in the automotive community because of the design and engineering. And, of course, they didn't sell to black people. Cadillac was General Motors' top-of-the-line and most expensive product, but the company had an unwritten rule of not selling its cars to black customers. But the Great Depression started to devastate the automotive market. Luxury manufacturers such as Cadillac.
Folks over 50 who've stopped driving at night because of their poor vision need to see this. This is how my dad used to see the world. I feel like a bad son because I never
faced a substantial decline in sales. In 1928, General Motors produced 1,700,000 vehicles, with 41,000 of them being Cadillacs. But by 1933, the production had dropped to just 780,000 vehicles, with only 7,000 of them being Cadillacs. That is a decline of 84%. And as the economy began to downturn, so did affluent white consumers. GM's executive committee would gather together in a meeting to make a decision on the future of the Cadillac division, who was losing so much money that they had plans to close the division down. Unexpectedly, Nicholas Dreiser, who was uninvited and in charge of GM service department nationwide, knocked on the door and asked if he could just be heard for 10 minutes. the executive committee granted his request. Drysdale stated that he had a plan to make Cadillac profitable in 18 months. While traveling around the country and visiting different service departments, he observed a significant number of African-Americans in the service department at Cadillac dealership. They were members of the small African-American elite, boxers, entertainers, lawyers, doctors, and ministers, but they were not allowed to buy a new car in the showroom. Drysdale found out that blacks were paying white frontmen $300 to purchase the cars for them. He asked the question, why should these men get several hundred dollars to profit that should go to General Motors? So he proposed a radical idea to target the African-American elite by marketing a special Cadillac for them. He believed that it would be an important step towards Cadillac becoming a profitable business. By targeting the African-American elite, he could increase their presence in the luxury market and build a relationship with a new customer base. Drysdale urged the executive committee to go after the African-American market or at least allow them to come into the showroom. GM would accept Drysdale's suggestion, and he would play a major role in increased sales of Cadillac during the 1930s. While the Great Depression was still in full swing, in 1934, Cadillac sales rose 70%, leading to GM to sell enough vehicles to make the Cadillac division break even that year. Furthermore, from 1933 to 1941, sales increased from 6,000 units to 66,000 units. That is an increase of almost tenfold. So on June 10th of 1934, Drysdale was promoted to general manager of the Cadillac division. Now, Drysdale's initiative ending the racist sales policy in 1930s apparently did not carry over to Cadillac marketing division. The division wanted dealers to stop turning away black customers, but it did very little to actually attract them. With the resurgence of the economy in the post-World War II era, Cadillac's print and television advertisements during that period continued to define excellence as white. This exclusionary advertising would extend all the way to the 1970s, with Cadillac portraying a world of glamour and excellence that only comprised of white people. But Cadillac wasn't the only one, because most automotive manufacturers during that time had advertisements that were completely white during the same time period. Additionally, individual car dealers maintained a significant degree of control over their showroom. According to a renowned automotive journalist, Warren Brown, his mother was unsuccessful in her attempt to purchase a new Cadillac from a dealership in New Orleans in the 1960s. However, she would ultimately be able to acquire her desired car, a 1965 Coupe de Ville, from a white man in a different location. Cadillac's diversity and marketing division served as a model for other divisions of General Motors and other automotive companies. This trend was primarily motivated by money more than morality. So that's how Cadillac became the first luxury car brand to intentionally market to black consumers. And in this case, Cadillac acknowledgement literally saved them from bankruptcy.
Interesting.
Michael. The second thing was the Lincoln Continental. The Lincoln Continental was there. You would go to black neighborhoods, you would see Lincoln Continental with two cars. The Cadillac and the Continental.
I remember that, but no, the point that they were making here is, I got a professor here, but they were like, black people like, please take our money, we want these cars. And they were forced almost to market. And a black man would tell them, look, we'll buy your shit, but this is what's going on. And they didn't really want to hear it. They didn't want it to be associated to anything black. And it does come down to white man's being, well, the white man's being white. Water's cooler, ice is colder, you know, all that stuff. All those things apply. Professor, you heard a bit of what was going on. I think you know what's going on here. And good evening.
I only caught a little bit of that. I know that the whole scene of cars, the automotive industry, we had to fight not only to get into the factories to build them, we had to go around back in a lot of places to buy them.
Right.
And it didn't matter whether the Cadillac or Model T. In certain places in the South, we'll call it Dixie, and sometimes further up than that. These folks that own, the people that own auto dealerships, they didn't mind special ordering the old Coupe de Ville, the old Buick.
Right.
Remember, you want to talk, I know you're talking about Cadillac, but remember the Oldsmobile was a black man's car.
That's right.
You hear? And remember also, the only difference between a Pontiac, between a Pontiac Chevrolet and a Oldsmobile was when you had round lights, like side by side, or light, one light above the other in the back. And I think that Buick was the light, had one where the light was above and below. Having said that, and I know by my uncle drove a Delta 88 primarily because his wife was on the plus side, and that was one of the few cars she could get in, not up comfortably, bless her heart. And not only was that the case, had they tried, the only other cars he had, and my brother, who is about 6'5", he was mostly into Lincolns, although occasionally there was a Dodge, a Chrysler, that he would drive. But these people, they didn't do anything. They didn't do much to truly cater to the black market. Black folks kind of bit it with money, kind of bit their tongue on certain things and went after what they wanted, and it didn't matter. It didn't matter if you had even with your money, you still had to go come around back and get your car. And
but
you had to have
give somebody money to buy your car. I mean, like, that's insulting. And on top of that, you see this parodied in a commercial where they say cash backing, which is some sort of slang for getting a discount. It's got to be a black thing. You know, it's not a black thing like a positive thing. It's a black thing like I'm trying to find a way to get over. And again, it's mocking a black man. For better or for worse, Allen Iverson deserves a lot better than the treatment that Kevin Hart gives him in that 15 to 30 second commercial. Am I wrong here?
I haven't seen it because I don't really watch TV that much.
No, Michael, it's black or black crime. This is what truly black or black crime really is. Mm-hmm. When you sit there, Kevin Hart, he's old enough to know about the practice.
And he's also a native of Philly.
Also smart enough to know what really happened that day. Therefore, and this is what happens. My God, X, Y, Z dollars if you do this.
That's what bothers me, Gary. He knew better. He knew better.
That's right. It's black on black.
Somebody gave him a script and he said, you know what? This doesn't work for me. How about we go in a different direction and just let me ad-lib it or whatever? No.
Remember Larry Johnson?
Yeah.
Grandma. Now. He did it for 2 years. He don't. I can't do this anymore. And he don't know why. Why are you dressing up black guys
It's unfortunate because, you know, I think everybody here has either seen the movie or is familiar with the movie Bamboozled.
And see, the thing is, that movie to me is timeless because now I believe it was made in the 90s or the early 2000s, but
in many ways,
Mike, I don't know if you agree, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek version of The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
I do agree. That's a great analogy. Yes. Yeah.
It's the same thing of certain black folks that are willing to sell their soul literally and figuratively for a few bucks. What's sad is after all these years it still applies. And again, that movie could have been made in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, well, more so probably like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is that they're willing to, you know, we're willing to sell our own souls sometimes literally just for a couple of bucks. And that's the unfortunate part.
And the sad part is they're saying, well, look, we have a product here. It's not like if you have it, in terms of if you can afford it, get one, please. We want you to drive one. It's like we have one, but no, you can't have it. It's like in an obtuse way, you make someone want it more because they think it's special. And you heard the argument that the brother man made. He said black elites, like you know Sugar Ray Robinson, had a pink Cadillac, and we knew he drove it around Harlem and all that good shit. But the whole point was it never would have become an item if they didn't make a fuss about it. He decided he was going to get one. And nothing wrong with getting yours when you can afford yours, but there's something wrong in making whoever it is say, all right, we want every brother and sister to have one of these, but talk to them like the consumers. I'm reminded of the commercial for the old soup company where he said, an educated consumer is our best customer. Well, clearly, these consumers were ignorant and they wanted to stay ignorant because all that mattered to them was getting a Cadillac. It wasn't the Cadillac itself. It was the idea of one because of its status attached to it.
Mike. The modern version of, you know, keeping up with the Joneses.
Yes.
Even when you don't know who the Joneses are.
That's right.
Thank you. And most importantly, why do you care about the Joneses? Because they could give a Muslim Shiite about you.
And you would go broke doing it.
That's right.
Yeah. We have sometimes gotta stop and look at, okay, from whence cometh our supply? Where is our money coming from? And what is the net effect of that money coming from your community or into your community? You know, what's the bottom line here? And my experience, we don't care. It's just like several guys I've listened to over the years, and I know one whose mother said, well, baby, how many cars can you drive at one time? You know, you buy your baby a car. Your baby can't even sit up straight in a car seat yet, and you buy a car for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it takes. Sometimes we got to take the blinders off and say, okay, I want to get Big Mama a house. You know, and you know, you all of us listen to Shannon Sharp talk about how he wanted to rescue his mom and his grandmother because they were smart. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys are like that. But at the same time, though, you know, your 15th cousin, what have they ever done for you? Not just lately. What have they ever done for you?
That's right.
And, just, you know, I don't even take money from my stepdaughter. And she does pretty good. And I said, no, that's yours. You earned it.
Right.
You helping out? Yeah, I mean, you want to cut me out something? Okay, fine. But don't feel like you are obligated. Because you ain't. And I've seen, mm-hmm. I've seen families fall apart behind the gifts because what they don't understand is, okay, before, you know, yeah, you got, you in the news, they're going to report you got just say $1 million. What they don't tell you is before your million comes to you, there is a stop at 1600 in D.C., where the president, they get their share.
Right.
Your agent go get three or more percent. You know, there's a whole litany of people who gonna get cut before they're cut out of your check before you get anything.
True that.
And because we don't understand money in the first place, it's easy to miss the fact that hey, by the time the money gets to you, that million might be you fortunate if you get a $500,000. And remember, that $1 million gotta last. That first up of that $1 million gotta last forever. And remember, also, even if you don't make another $1 million, according to your tax bracket for that year, you're gonna get through the next 2 years whether you make any more money or not.
Right.
You see, I look at some of the people, and I'll give you a good example. Jimmy Newsom still has the car his dad gave him when he came to college. 2 years after, two, I think it was 2 years after I graduated. He graduated in the 80s.
Right.
You see.
There's another aspect to this. The fact that, all right, if they make Cadillacs not affordable, they take a glamour factor out of it. But if they make Cadillacs attainable, then it's like anything else of value. It's worth something. I mean, you don't hear about anybody having problems with fixing a Cadillac. If you have the service Cadillac.
Mike. Yes. Mike. Here's okay, let's take the ownership of a Cadillac apart. Okay?
Okay.
And it doesn't matter if it's a Cadillac, Mercedes, Lincoln, whatever you want, a luxury car. You know you gotta all take right. them in about every month. Oil change, $200-$300 for a standard oil change. And you got just a pure maintenance is another car payment. It's equal to or exceeds what you would pay for a quote normal car maintenance car payment because you know like I say I watch some of my friends and you pay what? I don't think so. You could have bought your child. You let's take it away from cars. You are putting a house payment on your car every month that you could have, you know, we talk about wealth building. Ain't no way to build wealth that kind of stuff. And see, this brother that used to be head of the Shaw University Alumni Association from this area, he has one of those Cadillac pickup trucks. They were in his family have a big construction company. Now you listen to him talk sometimes, he whined and complained about how much it cost to have that, but he kept buying, you know, he bought new pickup trucks about every other year through his business, which was a smart move. But, you know, the guy used to be a banker, so, you know, he knows all the moves. But either way you turn, and he got up, one of their management contracts is worth $7 or $8 million a year. That the business that his daughter run, wink, wink, that his dad put together about 75 years ago. And I said, you know, if he would tell the truth, if he had told the truth, because he's deceased now, but if he had told the truth, you know, he was paying a premium for being rich, quote unquote, and it absolutely dug deeper than he thought. But, you know, he ran afoul of me because he wanted me to do some work for him for free, and I just, you know, my Republican side said, heck no, I'm sorry.
I feel you, Fred, but you got to remember, the guy who stepped to the executives in that meeting, he didn't say that out of the goodness of his heart. He said, I got a plan that will make GM and Cadillac a profit inside 18 months. He didn't say, you know what? All black folks want this car. He was like, certain black folks want this car and they'll do anything to get it. And they talked about the lengths that some people would go to, even to buy a car, even so far as to have somebody front them by having a white man put up the sale of the car if they gave him the seed money. And that speaks to the ignorance of the issue, because it goes back to that, you know, we can say anything to you niggas that we want. And I say that in regards to what Kevin Hart is saying to everybody in that commercial. It's like practice. You know, we know that we're insulting you, but we want you to spend money anyway. Practice. Oh, we know we're insulting you, but we can get away with that because ain't much you can do about it. All that shit is a slap in the face. And if Kevin Hart had any soul to him, he would say, you know what? This ain't me. I got a little bit of money. I can pass this one up. Give it to somebody else who might be hungry, who needs a shot. I don't need this. You know, they gave him the Oscars. He said something about gay folks. He probably wasn't even inappropriate, and they lost a bunny rabbit blinking mind, and he got shut out big time. So that Kevin Hart goes this far to push this, it makes me realize that once you're out there, you're on an island. It's like nobody gets away clean. Just like Kanye West is losing his damn mind, Kevin Hart, to a lesser degree, has lost all sense of self because he went for the dollar instead of for the principle.
Mike, something else to look at here is,
yes,
when you look across the board at, well, how to use the term, the Negro of the month, or the Negro of the year, or,
yes,
you know, the hottest Negro right now. You don't know the reality of what really goes on in the back room where these guys are anointed with these major contracts.
True.
We have discussed Steve Harvey. We've discussed several,
yep,
others. And We talked about Bill Cosby.
Tyler Perry,
nobody has been the wave higher or longer than he has.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, you know, you never know what we watch football games and basketball games and all these other things. We don't know what's said to these young men in the back room. Okay, yeah, we're going to get, you know, Think about it. Here you are, 20. I see where this young man with the with the Memphis has screwed up again.
Oh yeah.
So apparently he didn't learn the last time he backed his ass into a heater. So that's a colloquialism from the country. Y'all had them heaters on the floor and the ceiling, and so we had heaters that stood in the middle of the floor. Having said that, he apparently ain't learned yet, and certain things you don't do, and then don't do stuff with your stupid boy recording it and sending it out live on Instagram or whatever.
Thank you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And see, all these things factor into the mentality that we're dealing with. Whether, you know, I look at LeBron and a few others and say, you know, they must not even shit because everything that they do is recorded. Everything, everywhere they go, you know, you got people with cameras, you got people, and you ain't heard, what's the worst thing you heard about him? White folks usually protect their dollars as long as they're protectable. And,
that's true.
You know, I'd say you haven't heard. I think he apparently don't drive because I haven't heard about him speeding.
I can't say that. One thing I will say, there's only one time I know of where I think LeBron James made a misjudge and did something that was questionable. I forget the name of that bitch photographer. And I think it was Annie Leibovitz. She had LeBron dual cover with Tom Brady's wife, Gisele Bündchen. And it showed LeBron with kind of a smile on his face, and he's got his arm around Bündchen, and it was a copy, or it was played to be a copy of an old poster from World War II where a King Kong-like beast was ravaging, and the poster said, "Destroy the mad brute." And in this poster, LeBron, he was not the cash cow. He was the cash clown because he posed as this snarling, evil black guy, you know, with his arm around poor Gisele Bündchen, and it was like, woe is me. I think it was New York Magazine or one of those, but either way, the cover was, oh, you got to be kidding. And it wasn't out very long, but it was out long enough for LeBron to think, well, I fucked up. And they got rid of it real quick. But very rarely do we see somebody who's out in public like that make a snap judgment when they realize, oops, I did it again, and they correct the mistake so that it doesn't happen again. And unfortunately, we don't have too many athletes wrapped too tight like that. Ja Morant, I can't say he's a lost cause, but he's definitely in some sort of serious, serious trouble. And maybe David Stern would have roped him in a long time ago, but he's so bad, even Adam Silver wants to say, there, stop this, Mr. Morant. You know, you're making yourself look bad.
Well, Mike, something else that we keep missing here, and it's unfortunate to have to look at it this way, but remember, how old is this boy? You know, come on.
27? Huh? I don't even think he's that old.
Here's what we're dealing with. What we judge their mentality as well as their maturity, by all that money.
Right.
Okay.
And, John Moran is 23. He's 23, by the way. He's
23.
He's 23.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. As we tell the young men, we're doing rites of passage. We hearken back to the days when we were 16, 17 years of age, and how brilliant we were. And how many times our parents had to drag our ass out of stuff that showed us just the total opposite of how smart we thought we were, and really look back and say, what dumbasses we were at that age.
Yeah.
We acknowledge that we were that. And, you know, literally, this would be, what, his second year out of college, had he gone to college?
True.
For real. And the unfortunate thing is these young men are paraded out there, and they parade themselves out there in some cases, as is the case here. And we forget, everybody who came up with you can't stay with you. Everybody that came up with you don't deserve to stay with you. And sometimes you got to cut, you know, you got to cut Ray Ray loose. You know, I talked to one of my cousins that I grew up with. I talked to his wife sometimes, and she's amazed what, you know, the difference between who she married and me. And that's what I told her one day. Listen, I did not hang around with your husband. I hung around with his grandfather, but his grandfather was always was basically the guardian angel, because he was the one, he said, you know, don't be with this one, don't be with that one. And my aunt, bless her heart, she told me not to even be with her own son because he's crazy. And he's prone to do stupid stuff. And, you know, this is one you hear me talking about, my Aunt Lorraine, the one that sent me to college. So my mother died before I was 10 years old. And all the stuff that I heard about going to college started 3 years after she was gone.
Mm.
And literally, I'm 13, 14 years of age, and she's the one that's pushing me to study, pushing me to do what I need to stay away from this. You know,
that's,
you see, we don't do enough of that because the person, the people who talk to you are people you don't need.
That's the support system you have, Tony. That's the difference between a LeBron James and a Ja Morant. They were both young.
Yeah.
The people around them, that tells you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Remember a year or so ago, everybody got on LeBron's case that he jacked his son up?
Right.
You know, he did what his father should do. That come in, could you say, what are you doing? Who you play? Boy, you better quit sniffing. You better quit smelling yourself. That kind of, those kind of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we criticize. You know, there was a guy here in North Carolina who got put in jail for he went to school. His son did something, and he was one of them with a father like mine, and he just sort of took him to the bathroom and beat his ass, what it boiled down to. And, you know, they were charging him. They were going to charge him with assaulting a student.
Yeah.
Well, remember,
Agent Peterson got suspended for basically a year disciplining his kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I just say this? One thing in regards to about Morant? Look. I get it that he seems to have a liking for taking a bite out of that peanut butter and knucklehead sandwich. I get that. I do. You know, you cannot condone that. But it's interesting that, as far as we know, Ja Morant hasn't gone out and used his gun and shot at people again. For all the boogeyman, whatever stuff with Ja Morant and everything else, and it is stupid, but it's interesting that Ja Morant has been taking the coals for brandishing a gun. Meanwhile, you got folks that are doing their Charleston Heston routine about, oh, you're gonna take my guns and all this other AI. And meanwhile, every other week or every 2 weeks, we have these mass shootings, and
right.
Then all of a sudden, everybody has a collective brain fart. You know, it goes back to something where Chris Rock talked about a few years ago. Congress talks about guns. Congress has stuff on guns and everything like that. People just sort of look at it the other way. Black man mentions or gets seen with the gun. Everybody goes crazy. Now again, this is not the condone. Look, Ja Morant needs something's wrong with the boy. You know, to coin the phrase from King of the Hill, the boy ain't right, for lack of a better word. But let's not demonize him to the point where it gets to the point of ridiculous, where he's looked upon as the number number one thug. When we got just as many, if not more, white thugs in the police department, outside of the police department, in the military, that are actually killing people. Last I checked, Ja Morant hasn't killed anything but some brain cells in his head, unfortunately. So
true.
All I'm saying is put it in perspective. And again, not trying to condone the stupidity, but put it in context.
America has a problem. There a gun problem, right? If you're a black male and you have a gun, you are the enemy. I don't care who you are. You get a gun, and you go out there and you're a black man, God bless you. And we know that. So what the Ja Morant, the guy is not stupid, okay? He's not stupid. So he knows about this. It's his friend and buddy there. Look, when I was in high school, you had knuckleheads in high school, okay? And these knuckleheads were trying to prove that I go with you because you're knuckleheads.
Well, here locally, we're dealing with a situation, you know, and it's tragic in any perspective, but you're talking about the use of guns. You know, we have a situation here it's been about 2 weeks now, where this gentleman who is on the police force, and they see here what they do, if you are late for work, they call your house.
Right.
If you are, and if you don't answer, they send somebody to check your house. Somehow or another, the officer didn't come in, go to the house, find him and his wife on the floor dead. They were both deceased.
Okay.
She was shot. Now they did a full investigation. It took about it's taken about 2.5 weeks, and a couple of days ago they announced that they're classing it as a murder-suicide. She was shot several times apparently. He was shot once. And they were waiting to they could spin it just right. But, you know, my question is, you know, we're talking about what we see and what we don't see. This gentleman was diagnosed with PTSD several years ago before he exited the military.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still he's allowed to go out with a gun at the behest of, in our case, in this particular situation, of this local police department. there is I see some of these guys who do security at the transit center, and they got this white guy down there right now. And I can't put my finger on it, but there's something about the way he acts sometimes that just ain't right. And I say, you know, these people are, you know, he's allowed to go out representing the greater community with a gun, and we never know when he's going to pop off.
Yep.
And at the same time, though, we, you know, these the local governmental structure in the people accept them as quote unquote normal, and we don't know when they're going to flip out. And it's sad because when they do, they're going to get the full weight of the police department, the sheriff's department, and here locally we got about 5 municipalities that have police forces, plus the sheriff's department, plus the state. And see, in here, like this big, in the next few days, it's going to be Camp Liberty, but Fort Bragg, home of the airborne, has its own. It has its own police force as well as a detachment of the federal police that most of y'all have no clue even exists.
I'm wondering, as I'm sitting there listening to this, as I'm taking in vibes from that commercial, it's like, do you think people actually called up and said, what are you doing with this shit on the air? You know, how something it is.
Michael, when you said that 2 weeks ago,
yep.
I did not know about this.
All right.
Until you brought it up. So I got looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
I saw on the air during the playoff game. I thought, hell no.
I've seen it 3 times since I brought it up 2 weeks ago. But I have seen it.
This is my first time hearing about it, but I'm gonna look for it. But you know, here's the downside of social media as we see it now. Back in the day, you know, just say 5-10 years ago, we had a thing called common sense in most cases. Common sense has basically whitewashed the whole thing of being as they say now, common sense is not very common.
Right.
Because they call it, you know, I have the First Amendment right to do this. I got the First Amendment right to do that.
Exactly.
And then they always want to think about it now. They're always going back to the, you know, what was the premise behind this particular constitutional amendment on the part of the founding fathers? Well, somewhere in there's this statement that says, okay, you black folks, you ain't even human. Is that what you want to ride on? You had musket pistols, you had musket guns, rifles, and you had cannons, basically. 3 choices of weapons. Now you have an automatic this, automatic that, AR this, AR that. And somewhere along the way, common sense must be in the foxhole somewhere because it's scared to stick its head up. And I say, you know, it's really tragic because every time you hear these situations where common sense don't be common, you find bodies. And it's a truly sad part. You know, somewhere recently there was a shooting where this man shot these 2 baby daddies showed up at the house at the same time, and in the process, one shot the other while he was holding his child, and the child got basically hurt more than the father did. And the true sad part of all this is people in the community are practically blaming the baby and the guy trying to protect the baby when she got shot. It was his child.
Oh my God.
And but guess what though? He got his street creds. And see, even at almost 70 years old, I do not understand street creds.
Well, yeah, I had a buddy in my high school, and we rode everybody together for 4 years. He did it in a stupid senior year. I can't be with you. I just cannot be with you. We get to college. That boy. He turned the college out. Only got first year freshman. And he told the guy, "Oh, Gary Grace, I just like, you wait, I don't know you. I had no idea. SAC, we have to defend ourselves, and we don't do that very well either. I knew this guy was crazy, so I distanced myself from him."
Well, it's kind of hard to defend yourself, guy, when your humanity has been taken from you. It's one thing to know that they went out of their way to take it. It's another thing to know that somebody that would know better, or as Fred would say, act like they know, they don't know because they're too busy acting a fool and dehumanizing their own people for the sake of what? A few dollars? You know, I don't know what cash backing is. I don't care to know what cash backing is.
Frankly,
I don't
really
talk about cash backing. The whole point is it's been made negative by the mere fact that Kevin Hart would go into this posture and continue this thing. And that Steph Curry is an accessory after the fact because he's just going along with the script. Now his agent probably said, "Hey, you give so much for this. Just say that." And that'd be that. But Kevin Hart is the protagonist, and he acts as one. And as protagonist, he's doing their bidding by putting this negative crap up for consumption.
Well, until African Americans demand, I mean demand, you ain't doing it anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is this: you're gonna have Sambo, whatever you want to call him.
Yep.
You're gonna have Sambo wherever you go. I don't care what you do. You're gonna always have him.
Well, you know, you're right.
And these Sambos will undermine the black agenda. They always have. It's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
We have, we have to tell people who they are and why they do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that very well.
No. No, but there's ways of doing things. As my mother used to say, it's not what you do, it's how you do it. Now, Cadillac could have marketed themselves as, yeah, we have this great machine here, and we'd like for you to have one, but if you want one, it costs this much. They added, in addition to the price of the car, look what comes with the car. You know, you're a Cadillac owner. You know, there's prestige, all this other stuff that's added to it. All this is added to it. The guy who interrupted that meeting and said there are black elites that want the car, he's like, well, duh, there are black people who want the car, period. It's a practical car. It just happens to look nice. what else are you talking about? Now, I'm assuming his argument was good because clearly black people started buying Cadillacs. But what turned the Cadillac from an object of desire to Ron O'Neill driving across the street in a tricked out Fleetwood in Superfly? What made the car that much more desirable? That's what I want to know. And once you know that, you understand why, even if you never met Allen Iverson, what Kevin Hart did was so insulting.
Well, see, I don't know how old Iverson is now, but I know when he turns 55, he has something like $50 million waiting on him.
Something like that.
Now, what he had done, what and how he spent his money in between that, I think probably leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, I have a hard time dealing with the learning curve for some of these young men, because as you take a pause and go, okay, how long did he think about that? You know, who has he been listening to? Who has taken the time to talk to him, or who, you know, just basic stuff. You know, I have people I call my mentees now, and you know, and like I tell them up front, and they're mostly women. And I said, one of the biggest things is, you know, first and foremost, just tell me, give me the facts, tell me the truth. And I got one now that's hanging by her nails because she gave me a whole pack of lies. It wasn't hard to figure out once I started looking into it. But, you know, it's sad when you take time to go look at, okay, look at all that money and realizing he's a 23-year-old. And we all remember how brilliant we were at 23, 24, 25, yep. 30. You know, let's be honest and upfront. 5 years ago, how smart were we then? And so I'm hoping this young man will find that person who won't, you know, because one of my rules is you can't borrow money from me, and I can't borrow money from you.
There you go.
You see,
good point.
That means I have no, and the other thing I tell the young ladies is this, hey, if at any time you feel that I'm making a pass at you, let me know, hey, we can cut our losses right then and right there. Because
there you go.
Once you get, because I can tell you, know, I don't really want nothing from you. I need to be able to tell you like it is and be done with it versus you think I'm trying to get over you.
True.
Like in one of them case, ain't no way to her, you know, you think I'm big, it's, you should see her husband. He has nose guard written all over him.
Yeah. I got Patrick Law in the mix. Patrick, can you hear us?
What's up, folks? How's everybody doing?
Doing
right.
Good.
Good evening, bro. Patrick, you hit, I think the timing is right. We just brought up Ja Morant. And it's kind of hard to say, as Tony would say, you had a peanut butter and knucklehead sandwich. But it's like, how ignorant can ignorant be when you've run into this before and you know, I can't do this again? Who is around this guy?
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, it ain't knucklehead family. It's a whole meal. You know, there are some people who are not ready for prime time. And, you know, the bigger issue, you know, I should say the extended bigger issue for me are the people that he has around him that won't tell him no or what should be done because they're on the payroll, all right?
Right.
And they make things in which they know. First of all, the guy that took the picture should have never took the picture in the first place. What's that telling you right there? But
it's called hooked on stupid.
Well, that's true. There you go, friend. Let the church say amen. But also, you know, there's a guy was trying to tell me it's not the money. When you blow a half a billion dollars, finally, you blew the money. It's about the money. And the generational wealth that he could have added to himself for the team, they were about to make that young man the face of the league, and he'll never get that back again. Now, he'll play in the league, he'll make money. But that particular position, for what they want to market him around the world of basketball, not just the United States, he lost that. That's gone. But all is not lost. He didn't shoot anybody. Thank God. But, you know, it just like shows I'm saying before, you know, some people are not ready for prime time. They're not ready for what it is. And let me go on his side, too. There are things that he's dealing with now because – The best gauge of this was that they said 4 years ago he didn't act like this. Now money changes people, more pressure. I think there's pressure on him now more than ever in certain things. So hopefully he can, you know, take some time and get around the right people and get his daddy to be his daddy, not just one of his boys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's about a problem too. They being a father, they're being a mother. If I was a job around, what are you doing?
Well, we might be talking about the difference between an old 23 and a young 23.
Yeah.
And I hate to use the broadest comparison, but when LeBron was 23, he was working on a contract. He was making people money. He was selling soda, whatever it was that they needed. He stayed out of trouble. Cleveland made the playoffs almost every year, although they didn't win. And he got to a point where they were going to give him a fistful of money depending on where he was going to move. Never mind the politics underneath it all that tried to undercut him. The whole point was, as you said, Patrick, they were going to make him the face of the league. And the difference between me and Morant, his people knew about it, and he was being groomed with that understanding. Morant, where his people are, they dropped the ball.
And Mike, I want to add this to it, that it's unfortunate that it affects people and what he could have done with that money. Forget the family, what he could have done representing just ball playing. And a city like Memphis, come on, man.
Yeah,
well,
that's a good point. You know, we talk about Mahomes and what he's done for Kansas City.
Yes.
Morant and the effect he would have had on Memphis would have been seismic.
LeBron have wild ass parties. Did you hear about them? Thank you.
There you go.
I know.
That's what I was saying earlier. He must not even shit because nobody's been talking about what it smelled like. Because you know, as much of a microscope, he's been on what 20? Is that 20 years now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20 years.
And one of the worst things you can say about him that you heard about him was he jacked his son up in public, which he was supposed to do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? Don't get me started on that one.
we've heard Bill Cosby talk about how he tell his kids, no. Your mother and I are rich. You are my children. You have nothing. You heard Richard Pryor and several others say, no, this is not yours. This is our mind. Do you mind that?
And even
though in this young man's case, this Moran's case, yes, he's making money. He's making lots of money. But he ain't making as much as he could if he would do the right thing. And we got nobody there who say no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I admire my niece. I've watched her get on her son's case, and she tells me, "Hey, you're not from the trailer park. You're not from the hood. You're not from the project. You're not from the farm. I bought this house. It's your house to live here as long as you do what I tell you to do."
Exactly.
And he has two jobs. One, actually three. One is look out for his little brother. Two, work on his basketball. And three, make beats. That's all you got to do. You don't have to, you know, she runs a business, you know, and I didn't know wigs cost that much. But I see how she can fly. I see how she can fly all over where he's playing. Because, you know, There's some sisters who pay $1,000 plus for a single wig that take her 4 hours a week.
More than that, Fred.
I jokingly tell her, since she's actually third generation in the family, so you know she does what she does. But I admire her for making a commitment when he was like 10 years old. That's all you got to do. Now, if you bring home, you get one time to bring something that's below a B in my house. And then this was when she was in an apartment. When she went out and worked and bought her own house, she didn't let us help her with it at all because she wanted to show him how you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's already committed to do. He has another year left. But I say, you know, I admire him because most of the people that she tell him to stay away from, or she hears stuff about. There's something, you know. There's some families out there who are going to cause their sons to implode because of stupidity. We used earlier, all that money, all that money going to a 17, 18 year old kid. Unless somebody in the household takes charge of him and forces this young lady is already, I told her, he's the one I told him, teach him, make him go out and learn about the business of basketball. Because I know people mm-hmm. making millions off of basketball who ain't got no jump shot like he got.
Can't say, listen to his fame. I work with him. That's why I know him. Please. That's why I'm always amazed. You know, but it's LeBron's son. I ain't going to say that, but come on, man. Get some of your kids in the business. Stop trying to kick on a basketball court. I know one thing. What do the white boy Jews do on the team? They playing basketball? Thank you very much.
Not just going to state or whoever. Look at the faces you see when you look at basketball. You see a floor other than some of the West Coast and Mountain West conferences like that, of North and Northwest, or very far from the East Coast, what do you see? You see a bunch of black guys on the court, maybe one white guy gets it, he's like the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th guy, unless he's big or whatever. You know, unless you get that one particular white team, you know, most of you got a bunch of black dudes playing. But look at everything else. Most of the referees are white. Look at the table.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time we did a game I want to say it was Cameron Indoor Stadium. And it was funny because computerized stats was relatively new at the time, and Mr. Moore had practically had a carnal corner on the market for a number of years.
Uh-huh.
And we would go to these different places, and lo and behold, guess what? We were, other than the teams, you don't see a lot of black people over at Carmichael Auditorium. Let me correct you. The Dean Dome. You don't see a lot of black folks at. Over in when we go to Wake Forest Dean, you know, ACC. When the ACC, it was real fun. The ACC women's tournament started here in Fayetteville and grew into what it is now. And guess what? Other than D. Todd was the head of the Commission of Women's Sports for the ACC, I think she had two black people that worked for her. Richmond folks, was white folks, all making money off the same thing. And at the time, there was no image and likeness, so you got a bunch of girls out there who were just playing for scholarships.
And guys, too.
The money was being made by the coaches and all the other, and that's what the term, ancillary things that goes on around the teams. Even the medics and the managers were making more than the girls who were playing. Because they learned the business of basketball.
Your point's for attention. And it's a situation. I told Mike this season, I'm in Ohio right now, but some stuff wasn't. I got taken care of with a reunion, but some business too. And the whole time I'm staying is downtown, on the side of a little off away from the mid downtown near the Capitol. We're in the hotel in here. And all businessmen and insurance men in there, executives in there. I was talking to some guys today for a little bite to eat. And I said that to say this. Remember, you were talking about young people who don't understand the level of understanding of you don't have to play. Now, one of the guys was one of the directors for the Columbus, the hockey team? And
the
Blue that's the very thing. Blue Jackets, yeah. Talking about how he's gearing his son, you know, for go work in the intern as a summertime. Nothing special, just doing fluffy work in the office. What does that do? That gets you the scope of what they're doing. And I'm saying that I saw with the next same thing. I said, guys, you ain't got no basketball skills, but there's other things that you could do. But first of all, they got to see it first. If they don't see it, they don't know what it is. And
there you go.
That's the first. You got to see it first.
You know, I used to joke with Mr. Moore, Eric Moore. When we would go different places, I would say, at some point I would say, okay, have you spotted all the doors? You know how to get out of here? Just in case something don't go right?
Mm-hmm.
And he would go like, uh-huh. Because you go to some of these places, the Dean Smith Center, they got this one block of about 1,500 seats for students. The rest of them things are paid for, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and we don't pay for, we don't delve into a lot of that. And you know, the whole thing with following the team and being a fan and all that kind of stuff is ludicrous when you look at where is the money coming from and where is it going. You don't hardly see no black folks. You don't hardly see no black folks out there. Doing
that, but
playing.
Let me ask you this question, Fred. I'm looking at, what question, Mike? Fred, have you seen over the last year, with all the work that you do in research, have you seen any uptick in HBCU schools, because you would know much better than anybody here, of developing and broadening their sports information department in terms of getting information, in terms of setting apart students to get more involved. Have you sensed any more of that?
Don't make me cuss.
Okay, yeah. I understand.
The real answer, no.
Okay.
I'll do it the way my mom would have me do it. No, sir. Not really. Unfortunately, at many schools, they have a sports information director and all that kind of stuff on the surface.
Are you doing two jobs?
The downside of it is they usually work at the behest of the public relations department for the institution in some kind of way, even if they're on the dime for the athletic department. They back up the school's PR department. The true downside of it is, and I was watching, he's finally talking now. You know, when Florida A&M started trying to go Division I 10+ years ago, one of the things they shrunk was their SID department.
Yeah, it messed up. I do know that.
And here you are trying to go where everybody in the place has each of your sports has its own SID department.
Right.
I told you one time I had to get some pictures from University of North Carolina, and I called the SID at that time, who was the guy in charge, actually worked with basketball. His staff, along with the coaching staff, went to Myrtle Beach for part of a week, along with, they did this outing after the season was over. Okay. The women's basketball team has a three-person team that did to cover just women. The golf team had its own person.
Mm-hmm.
The men's and women's soccer teams had their separate SID staff. What else did they have big at the time? And remember at that time their soccer team, you go down the list, they had like, I want to say roughly 50 people who worked in sports information. This is the University of North Carolina at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the late 90s. Sylvia Hatchell was still the women's coach, and Black HBCUs treated sports information like it was a third, like a fifth wheel of a car.
Yeah.
And they did not, and to this day, that's how they still do it overall. A few schools got it right because Norfolk was okay because Norfolk was on a certain level. Naturally, Hampton kind of. Howard, unfortunately, wasn't that much better because they had a lead guy who was great. They just never supported him the way he should have been.
Well, Hampton was doing okay. When they came up here and played that game at the Rock, and they'll have a next year sponsored by Michael B. Jordan, the four HBCU teams. I got a copy of their work. It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all. It wasn't bad at all.
They found a way to do great. I mean, listen, these young men and women, I take my hat off to them because I look at some of the media guys that I have in the work that went in. You know, Clark A&M media guy was 200 pages. Big picture of the works. They got the job done, but it was always a stretch to get the job done. And then November, when you got volleyball, you got basketball, men and women, you got football, cross country, all them sports bouncing, and they had their own brotherhood and sisterhood, and they got stuff done. Mr. Moore did a lot of work on getting them to cooperate. That way, when you were on the road, they would back each other up. I remember one year, the guy from here in Fayetteville, I went with him, as a matter of fact, to do stats for somebody. And Mr. Moore, that was what Iodine did, was help fill in the gaps where people at the top were not willing to spend the money because they treated athletics like an extracurricular activity. It was not part of the sports information business. And because of that, a lot of times, I know a couple of instances where people almost got killed because they couldn't travel with the team, so they had to drive. And here you're coming on a 3-4 hour trip back to your, because you got a game or whatever in the morning at the back home, so you got to get back home, leaving a game at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. It got better in some cases, and John Holly was another one that did a real good job of bolstering sports information because he used interns.
Yeah,
and I remember when he came to the CIAA, he had 7 interns.
Yes, you got to have that. You got to have that. Wow. I was curious. There's a young lady that's in our program that's going to choose between Morgan and Howard. She actually was a major sports management. I'm trying to get her to understand. You got to go someplace if you want to do that, that can cater to that curriculum. Not just have a course, but cater to that curriculum. So that's what I was wondering, all the explaining. And also the fact that Byron Allen opening up some more in terms of games for next year, as we look, because they already began to lay the outline for the games of when they're going to play next year. I figured maybe because of the bump that the last couple of years that they've had HBCUs had on TV, that they might expand departments. But if you don't know, I don't know. So I'm just curious. That's all.
Sometimes you got to go in these places and help carve it out.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, I look at some schools where they come from. Because, quiet as it kept, Winston-Salem State, for a long time, they had a guy that worked in public relations that actually was working for the newspaper that did their doing Earl's days. But mm-hmm. Mary Garber didn't do. Dr. Hauser did it for a while, but we never. You'd be shocked at how little emphasis was put on some of that stuff back then because you had people who were, it was sports. It was extracurricular activity. It was not a priority, although they wanted to look like one.
And listen, that will catch up if you're not doing it right. That's for sure.
You see, when you like to look at some of those people who did those jobs, and they did great jobs based on the little bit they had to work with.
Well, I'm looking out. See, I'm just curious as I look into stuff because I'm trying to find out. They've already started naming some games already. Times are ready for next year's game, so. I'm just looking for stuff. That's all.
Yeah. Let's see. A lot of these schools, they went to this system of actually taking, they take the program that they run the books off on, they make the books with, and they would take that and just take a copy from this year, gut it, and then take all the, move all the seniors and juniors, but not putting in wait. They got to wait till July. At least, actually, in some cases, they got to wait till August to get the pictures of the freshmen. And see, that's freshman football and every other fall sport. And unfortunately, in some cases, coaches aren't the most cooperative when it comes to, putting these things out there because they want the practice time. And even though practice time has been reduced, they look at practice as being on the field, but there's so many hours you got in this classroom stuff. So, to their credit, most of the schools have gotten better. And I'm not talking about the zoo they had at Jackson State last year. I'm talking about the reality stuff. And see, Jackson State was one of the schools that always had a good system because they had a good, Mr. Jefferson used to get kids who wanted to major in journalism or whatever. Mm-hmm. They would intern in his office because he, when I was down there in 99 to watch them play, they played, weekend they played Grambling. That was like being in heaven because you had two schools who did it really good. Colin Nicholson was no longer at Grambling at the time, but I forget the young man who was there. But you know they had good books, they had information. It was other than having to drive 20 hours to get there because of the hurricane, I went out one road and hurricane coming in another one. And it was because they couldn't guarantee a flight, so I drove down and drove back. Those schools and overall the SWAC schools are pretty good. The thing that helped Bethune-Cookman, for instance, the thing that helped them was the former AD was also an SID, so he knew what it took for it.
Gentlemen,
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I was getting there before we close up. Patrick, we were talking about the billion-dollar brother, and we may not see one yet, but we may see one that's about $600 million in Ohtani. Yeah. What's the latest?
I reached out to some guys I've known for years or involved in marketing various times, and I work with some marketing, and one's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and I look at what the Yankees are doing in terms of their contracts, and also the Dodgers and the Angels, and it's coming. Ohtani is going to get close to $600 million, and I have no problem with it because as a hitter, he's worth damn near that much, but as a pitcher, he's good. But imagine he is global as can be. Understand, despite the politics of China and the United States, China loves basketball. And Xiang was Ohtani is taking some of that shine from that because of playing baseball. So between the two markets, the United States about $200 million, another $300 million from China putting stuff in. He should make close to $600,000 on a contract.
I might have to come out of retirement.
I told my man Dick, Ron Dick, is the marketer for he was Pittsburgh. I said he's beyond the hype.
Well, I think that's the point. You want to get past that, so that you got to get way plus or minus on your own. And while we know certain people have, it looks like Ohtani has the right people covering him. We're at the point there. It's time for last licks. Reggie, can you hear me? Reggie, are you there?
He's not scrimping right, man.
Yep, scrimp the race. There you go.
I can't say
no more. So go on ahead. Patrick, take a plate. Last mix. Serve it up.
There's a session, small session going on right now that I think is interesting. Right now, the NFL... I forgot what it's called, but here's what it is.
They're having meet and greets for potential coaches in the NFL, primarily head coaches. What it is, people, several, maybe 10, 12 owners, where they get to meet these guys up close and personal about their hope, maybe opportunity to get involved with the organization as a coach. Even though it has its pluses, I'm pissed. And
why?
For one reason, what is Leslie Frazier going there for? If you don't know who Leslie Frazier is now, then you should be in the league.
Hello.
Why is he going? And he's not coaching. You know what I mean? He's not coaching this year. I mean, why is he? Did A's have to do a meet and greet with his non-coaching ass? Come on. I mean, it has a good taste in my mouth. Even though it has some credibility in its initial context, but behind the scenes, come on, there are guys who they didn't know for white guys, they didn't know who even coached last year got head coaching jobs. Now, brother, got to go meet
you. Right about that.
Mm-hmm. Come on.
Yes, that's sad. And it sounds like the same old song. We'll see where it goes, though. We'll keep an eye on it.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie, are you there? One more time, Reggie.
He has some rice, grits, and shrimp.
Well, make me something to go, please. Professor, come on with it.
Well, one of the reasons I haven't seen that infamous commercial you were talking about is I've been working on a list of putting together a profiles of 1,000 HBCU grads, and over the last few weeks, I had lost some stuff and so forth, but I was having to write some out. But I found an old file, get this, Patrick. It was done in on a WordPerfect. I mean, was WordPerfect a Word 97?
Okay.
But I was able to pull it up, and without gloating too much, I did some great work back way back then, and I found 200 plus profiles in this book that I was doing at the time. I said, there's nothing else. That this is where you found out there is a guy. So I would have had to rewrite them in several times. Some of these people I haven't really seen or heard of lately, so I might even miss some of them. But I say, this is the actually fourth major step that we got to put together a list of 1,000 plus HBCU grads, or I would call them distinguished alumni. And to be nice about it. We've done a lot of really good stuff across the country and around the world, and it's just a matter of us taking the time to relearn some of this stuff and put it out front, because this is where telling our own story pays off to the max.
Let
me reach that www.blackheritage.com. I'm also on Facebook is HBCU Heritage Center, and you have books available.
Yes, indeed. www.blackhistory.
Mike, I'm gonna throw one thing more. Fred, please. I would suggest that you do some research on AI mechanism writing. Because we have some stuff shown to us at our station. It's deadly. Well, they can write.
I'm still focusing on that. It's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. You need to reach out to some people to help you out in terms of understanding what this AI is doing to writers and information.
Yep.
Because, for instance, you found the notes of everything that you had back to your backup. Because this AI stuff is taking just bits and pieces of something and writing out, and people are going to that source.
No shit. That's true. Yep.
If you got anything on it, email it to me. I got a class I'm getting ready to take in AI for actually for Longberg Institute, and some of the stuff they're going to be doing will be a bonus.
Good.
Okay.
Good. You know about it because people writing
shit
is tough.
To stay on it. Come with me if you want to write. Guy.
Yes, sir. Well, this past 2 weeks, new graduates go across the stage and get their degree. As I used to look at University of California Golden Bears, Hampton Pirates, A&T Aggies. Remember, after you graduate, go back to your school and educate the young ones.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to the school and tell them, I got my degree here. You can get your degree here, too. They need inspiration. They need your advice. You've been there and done that. Congratulations to all the grads who had 2 weeks all over this country. And salute to the class of 2023. Graham McCoy. Mm-hmm. Friday, Music Box on Sunday, it'll be 1960 over again.
Uh-oh. There you go. Put a quarter in the Music Box, for real. Now, tonight, we were supposed to have my colleague Jenny Bork on to give you a preview of the Preakness, but we are going to do a special Pack the Popes before the week is out on the big race. You see the breakdown and who we like, and we'll serve that up before Saturday. Actually, Gary, we might rate your show and knock on the door and say, let us in as we talk about this. So we'll see what happens. But before we go, just like we started the show talking about why black people love Cadillacs, we want to say, you know, there's that supposed talking white, and there's the black set. So what's black set, and why do people keep talking about it?
Have you ever noticed this phenomenon? See, I gotta understand that I'm not paying for.
Oh boy, it's a white boy summer. Bad gal.
Show me, get your ass in here.
You gonna roll up to that way? You gonna be like fuck fair? I'm attractive.
Black scent.
Black scent is essentially right there in the name. It's a portmanteau of black and accent. So black scent, or what I'm thinking of as vocal blackface, are kind of interchangeable. They're both instances of people who are not black adopting African-American English or African-American vernacular English.
Seems like it's been in show business for decades. Yeah. So why do people keep using it? Again and again and again. Let's get a historian's take on why entertainers use black sense.
You ain't not going.
And then the second thing that makes find so interesting is that it launches a young Elvis Presley onto the international stage in a major way, and he becomes lauded as sort of the king of rock and roll, whereas Big Mama Thornton is largely forgotten by mainstream audiences as being one of the major architects of rock and roll. During this time, radio was largely segregated, and it meant that black musicians and white musicians were rarely, if ever, played on the same radio station. So we start to see the first all-black radio stations at the tail end of the 1940s and into the 1950s, and the first black radio station was WDIA in Memphis.
The Blues Brothers Blues began in Memphis, Tennessee. WDIA invites you to join up and asking the man upstairs to smile on us today.
So even white artists like Elvis were huge listeners to stations like WDIA and these race music stations, and they were being influenced by the new culture and the new sound that they were being introduced to.
A lot of people, when they heard Elvis, thought he was black, didn't they?
At first, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people playing black music. He's a white guy.
Yeah, but at first he was playing more like rockabilly. He wasn't really getting into the things that he started to do later. But when he started to do that, then he started tearing heads, including mine.
The real issue at hand here is that there was an imbalance of power. So while white artists were busy sort of adopting, covering, and appropriating black artists' songs and seeing huge profits from these covers, black artists were largely not seeing the same profits, not seeing the same success, and not having the access to the music industry that white artists were. Early rock and roll was invented by black people. Folks like Chuck Berry were duck walking and swiveling their hips before Elvis ever came on the scene.
Unforgettable.
Nat King Cole was being run out of town, beat up by mobs.
So near a bar.
Whereas Elvis, who's, you know, making young white teenagers swoon, is seen as a sex symbol, someone who's edgy, someone who's ahead of his time. So there is a double standard.
Wait a second. So Elvis sang like black musicians and became the king of rock and roll. But it looks like the trend of white people speaking like black folks started even earlier.
One of the earliest examples of vocal blackface was definitely the radio show Amos and Andy.
Andy, wake up, wake up.
Hello?
Can't answer the telephone this year.
Come in here and wake me up like this.
It premiered in 1928, and it was wildly popular and successful. Millions of Americans tuned in 5 nights a week to listen to these two white actors who got their start on the minstrel and vaudeville stages basically perform as black men. There was this sort of racial tension and anxiety caused by the Great Migration. Millions of people fleeing from the South in order to escape restrictive laws and racist laws, as well as class tension and anxiety caused by the Great Depression. And so people were looking for ways, particularly white people were looking for ways to reinstate or reaffirm their control on the racial hierarchy of this country. And I think that made the show, Amos and Andy, even more appealing to these audiences.
So appealing that they made spin-off movies.
Hey, Kingpin, you're coming over to talk over the thing, dropping in.
Cartoons.
Andy.
Even a TV show.
Well, boys, it looks like I'm the big winner.
The Amos and Andy show actually led to the first all-black cast of a television show in history, and I think that complicates the ways that we have to look at its legacy. These actors who were on the show were instructed to maintain the black scent and maintain the sort of caricature of the earlier radio program because that's what made it successful, and the producers of the show thought it was more authentic.
How do you do that? Sweet.
By forcing these actors into sort of a narrow role, they were essentially forced to adopt this really stereotypical version of themselves and reflect back to white audiences what they expected more than what was actually authentic to the black experience.
Where's that husband of mine? He didn't come home last night. He left us no saying he was going away to make his fortune and he'd come to me later.
In some ways, it gave opportunity to black actors who were looking to express their talents, and in other ways, it perpetuated the violence and the racial stereotyping of the original program.
But Professor Bainbridge, this was the 1950s. Surely we've made some progress since Amos and Andy, right?
Don't sleep. Don't sleep. Because she might disappear, right? Well, right? She getting that good. She likes it.
The continuing controversy around Awkwafina and her use of black scent has a lot of different moving parts, and it started very early in her career.
My
make a girl panty preen. Yo, spread hepatitis C.
But she adopts sort of an African-American accent while she's rapping. And then after that, she becomes better known for her acting than her music. But even in television and film, she's still adopting this very particular African-American vernacular English while she's performing. And she's largely performing funny characters, comedic characters.
You're going to roll up to that way. You're going to be like, fuck, fuck, fuck.
Seeing her gain success for using Blackcent was extremely problematic, but I also think she got more critique specifically because she was a woman of color. And I think that people are more likely to hold women of color to a higher standard than they are other groups.
Hmm. But it sounds like a lot of people on the internet speak with a Blackcent now.
When someone says, like, period, sis, whatever, snatch, all that, it's very much like internet culture. I think the argument that internet lingo or teen speak is synonymous with Blackcent is actually quite harmful and can be really a slippery slope, because in some ways it normalizes adopting and appropriating Black accent or adopting and appropriating Black culture as just being the norm. While some folks are saying, well, it's internet lingo, it's internet speak, they're also, you know, becoming huge TikTok celebrities and influencers off of doing these actions.
A little,
when a Black person does adopt, say, you know, A-B-E, they're seen as ungrammatical, less professional, less desirable, and less likely to be hired.
Wow. That double standard is literally costing people their jobs. So what can we do about it?
I'm not a fan of judging people online, but I do think holding people accountable could look a lot of different ways. Going back to Aquafina, one of the ways she could have credited the Black community for sort of some of the innovation that she was, you know, taking credit for with her Blackcent would have just been simply saying sorry. I don't profess to be an Aquafina historian, but I think it's important for us to think of gentler ways that we can engage with each other and engage as communities of color, because we do have a shared destiny and also a shared sense of politics that makes it really important to think about solidarity. So I wonder if there are just other ways of engaging.